This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Saunderson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 20th of September, these are our main stories. Israel says its airstrikes on southern Lebanon have hit more than 100 Hezbollah targets. In the US, the repercussions of false claims by Donald Trump that immigrants are eating pet cats and dogs. The EU sends $11 billion to rebuild the communities in Central and Eastern Europe devastated by Storm Boris. Also in this podcast,
the Iron Maiden Gallop, the sound that powers so many of their songs.
Fans rejoice as Iron Maiden announced the heavy metal band is about to be heard live once again, 50 years after it was formed. We begin this podcast with the latest on the airstrikes in southern Lebanon after Israel launched some of the heaviest bombing since the October the 7th attacks. The Israeli military says its warplanes struck more than 100 Hezbollah sites, including rocket launchers ready to be fired. Israeli warplanes flew low over Beirut, creating sonic booms, as Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, a proscribed terrorist organization, condemned this week's exploding devices attacks. At least 37 people have been killed and thousands more injured since Tuesday by exploding pagers and walkie-talkies used by members of Hezbollah. The Lebanese mission to the UN says a preliminary investigation found the targeted devices were professionally booby-trapped before arriving in Lebanon and were detonated by sending emails to the devices. Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, accused Israel of being behind that operation and promised a response.
There is no doubt that the aggression that took place is a major one. And as I said in my speech, it is unprecedented and will be met with tough retribution and just punishment where they expect it and where they do not.
Our correspondent Hugo Bashega in Beirut listened to the speech and gave us this analysis.
I think it was very interesting that he acknowledged that this was a massive security blow, unprecedented in the history of Hezbollah. As expected, he promised a harsh punishment, but he didn't give any indication of how this response is going to be. But I think it was also interesting that there was no change in Hezbollah's position. Again, the indication is that Hezbollah is not interested in an escalation in this conflict with Israel, with seeing that for almost a year, Hezbollah has been attacking positions in northern Israel, saying that this is in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Hassan Nasrallah again said that this campaign, these attacks are going to continue unless there is a ceasefire in Gaza. So this has been the main hope here to de-escalate these tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. And those negotiations for a ceasefire in Gaza have been unable to reach a deal. Hassan Nasrallah also reflected on those decisions that have been taken by the Israeli authorities to add the return of those residents who've been displaced from communities in northern Israel as one of the war goals. He said that these attempts by Israel will not succeed, and again, that these attacks by Hezbollah are going to continue. So no clear indication of what Hezbollah is going to do. Again, as expected, some harsh words against Israel, saying that these attacks that happened here amounted to a declaration of war. He said it was a massacre. And again, reflecting on the suffering of the population here over the last 2 days.
Hugo Bachega in Beirut. Well, Israel hasn't admitted it was behind the recent attacks via walkie-talkies and pagers. Israel's Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, said battle plans for the Israel-Lebanon border area had been approved. I got more from our correspondent, Daniel De Simone, in Jerusalem.
The Israeli airstrikes today really continue, frankly, almost daily airstrikes that have been taking place for quite a long time. Quite a large number of strikes today, perhaps a bit more than normal. And the timing of them was certainly interesting because they were happening at the same time that Hassan Nasrallah was speaking. They started just beforehand. And I think that timing may not be a coincidence. It may have been intended to send a bit of a message to him and to Hezbollah. But the strikes really were a continuation of Israel trying to degrade Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon. It's become a daily occurrence, this exchange of fire, Hezbollah firing rockets and drones into northern Israel, and Israeli fighter jets flying over and attacking Hezbollah positions.
And what about these reported Israeli plans to take over southern Lebanon?
Israel has set out, as Hugo was saying, a war goal of turning Israeli citizens who've been displaced in the north to their homes. And there's around 60,000 Israelis who've been displaced. Until this week, there were three kind of core war goals of the war that started last October. And they related to Hamas and to Gaza. The Israeli security cabinet added another one earlier in the week, and that was returning the citizens. That was like a formalisation of the north, the northern front, as being part of this war. And this week, the Israeli defence minister has spoken about a new phase of the conflict, and the fact that the conflict is kind of moving north. They moved a division of the army north to the north, massively increasing the troop numbers there. And so what they've said is what their goal is. They haven't said how they're going to achieve it. And at the moment, we are seeing a continuation of the airstrikes. Obviously, we saw the explosions in Lebanon through the walkie-talkies and the pagers. Israel not accepting responsibility for that or denying responsibility for that, but widely being blamed for it. And frankly, it's hard to see who else it was. And that may be part of the same strategy. But I think whether there's actually a ground incursion, we still don't know. And they certainly haven't said they're going to do that yet.
Daniel DeSimone in Jerusalem. Washington continues to urge restraint, believing that a diplomatic solution in the Middle East is achievable and urgent. Briefing United Nations Security Council members earlier, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East peace process, Tor Wennesland, said both sides needed to avoid any further actions that would further worsen the situation.
I would like to express my grave concern over the growing risk of wide-scale regional escalation. The series of explosions across Lebanon and rockets fired towards Israel in recent days adds to the volatility. I call on all sides to refrain from steps that will further exacerbate the situation and take immediate steps to de-escalate.
So, how precarious a moment is this for the Middle East? I asked our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
Well, it's not the most dangerous moment, even though that's what the Saudi ambassador to London, I think, has said, because there are constraining factors on both sides here. For Hezbollah, they know that if they hit back too hard at Israel, Israel will hit back even harder, and that will severely damage Lebanon's infrastructure. That country is already on its knees economically and financially, and the last thing it needs is a full-scale war. So Hezbollah know that if they provoke Israel too much in their retaliation, it's going to be costly for Lebanon, for their host country. At the same time, they know that they've got to do something. So there wasn't much of a clue in Hassan Nasrallah's speech. There never is. There's always a lot of fiery, angry rhetoric. If anything, it was a pep talk for his troops, kind of morale booster for them. But he did say, you won't necessarily hear about how we're going to retaliate. Maybe that's a hint. Maybe it's an empty threat. Who knows? For Israel, the constraining factor here is that although there is a lot of political pressure on the government to resolve the situation on the northern border, which is depriving well over 60,000 Israeli citizens from being able to go back to their homes and farms and businesses, and an even greater number on the Lebanese side, they know that if they are going to go into Lebanon, as they have done in the past, in previous wars, they're going to get a bloody nose. Hezbollah's got a very powerful arsenal. And on top of those constraining factors, you've got diplomats like Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, trying to call for calm. But it's not that easy I don't think Hezbollah or Iran, for that matter, are in much mood for calm, because Iran is still smarting at the July the 31st assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas political leader, in an Iranian guest house in Tehran, in the heart of the capital. And that is, humiliating and embarrassing for Iran. So there'll be plenty of people in the security establishment there who want vengeance for that.
Can any pressure be brought to bear internationally? You mentioned the Americans. What about the United Nations Security Council?
I'm not expecting that to have a great deal of effect, to be honest. The real problem here is that the Gaza conflict seems to be intractable. And we know what the problem is there, which is that the Israeli government doesn't want to sign something that hands over the control of the southern border of Gaza, something called the Philadelphia Corridor, because it doesn't trust anybody, including the UN, not to stop Hamas weapons being smuggled back in and launched at Israel's cities and towns. So for their part, Hamas say, well, we're not going to sign up to a deal and hand over our prize, the Israeli hostages, unless we can be sure that Israel is going to leave Gaza and not come back. And Israel's refusing to give that guarantee. And the Americans are clearly getting very frustrated with what they see as Netanyahu's intransigence.
Frank Gardner. One of the most memorable moments of the US presidential election campaign was during the TV debate this month, when Donald Trump claimed that immigrants are eating pet animals in the town of Springfield, Ohio. The claim has been denied by authorities and ridiculed, particularly online.
They're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets.
Well, it's certainly put Springfield on the map. The small city has experienced an influx of migrants from Haiti in the last few years. But with all the recent attention on the town, it's now been forced to shut down schools due to bomb threats, has braced itself for right-wing rallies and dealt with hate speech online. Mike Wendling went to Ohio to see how residents are coping.
Rumors are swirling here in Springfield, Ohio. There's talk of white vans moving immigrants into the town, when really they're moving them to and from their factory jobs. Far-right groups have been marching in the streets, and there are fears they'll return. Earlier this week, local schools were closed by hoax bomb threats. It's letting out time at one of the primary schools here in Springfield, and there's a discreet but definitely noticeable police presence. The authorities have ordered state troopers to be posted outside of all the schools in the district here because of the dozens of bomb threats, most of which the governor of Ohio says have come from overseas. Parents here are concerned, a little bit wary, but most of all baffled as to what's happened to this community over the past week.
There's always a concern. There's always going to be that concern when you send your children to school. With everything that's going on in the world today, I think they need to leave the schools out of it.
I'm up here getting my grandkids at the same school I got my kids from. Everybody's cats are safe. Dogs are safe. You go up here at these factories, this big factory, go in the bathrooms, there's kill the Haitians on the walls. I mean, it's bad.
Despite the rumors, the one thing that most parents here agree on is that the granddaddy rumor of them all, which started all of this off, is absolute bunk. It's been just over a week since Donald Trump stood at the podium on a national TV debate stage and said something out loud that had its origins in the dark corners of the internet.
They're in the park grabbing up ducks by their neck and cutting their head off and walking off with them and eating them.
This unsubstantiated claim was made at a city council meeting in August. It went viral, as did a Facebook post recounting a cat-eating allegation written by a Springfield resident who attributed it to the friend of the daughter of a neighbor. She's since taken the claim back, but not before it became entangled in the fractious U.S. political race and turned this normally quiet city of 60,000 in southwest Ohio upside down.
Haitians who have just been minding their business, going to work and coming home, are now terrified to walk on the streets.
Laura Kovaleski grew up in Springfield. She and her Haitian mother run a translation and advice service for immigrants here. And she says life has changed over the past week.
There's a woman who came with her small son, who's probably around 4 years old, and she just wanted a one-way ticket to Brazil because she's terrified of someone killing her son. Her walking home, her transit to home, she gets people yelling at her, screaming at her, and she knows it's hateful, but she doesn't understand what they're saying.
Local business owners have praised Haitians for their hard work. They've revitalized many of the factories here, but the tensions in the community are evident. Haitians here have told me of stories of harassment and more serious incidents, including assaults. But in the face of all the negative attention, there are signs that Springfielders are sticking together. At a Haitian restaurant in South Springfield, businessman Jacob Payne takes a quick break from ferrying dishes of rice, beans, and stew from the kitchen.
For the past week and a half, 96% of our guests are non-Haitian. Before, we did have a few here and there. You know, they wanted to try the culture, try the food out of curiosity. Now they've been coming by numbers to support us.
For now, things here in Springfield may have quieted down. The governor of Ohio says bomb threats have tapered off, but Springfield's moment in the spotlight might not be over quite yet. Donald Trump has suggested he'll hold a rally here in the near future.
Mike Wendling. Heavy metal fans around the world have been celebrating Iron Maiden's announcement of an international tour to mark the group's 50th anniversary. The iconic British band have so far committed to dates across the UK and Europe next year and are thought to be about to reveal more destinations for 2026. Michael Hann, author of Denim and Leather, The Rise and Fall of the New Wave of British Heavy Metal, spoke to us about Iron Maiden's impact on heavy metal music around the world.
They're a hugely important group in the history of heavy metal because they proved that you could stay true to your roots and be successful. When in the mid-80s lots of bands were turning to makeup and to poppy choruses, Maiden doubled down and they became bigger than ever as a result. And their influence on metal has been profound in the sense of being role models for fidelity to metal. I mean, their sound is so distinctive that it's hard to copy them without obviously copying them. So you won't get that many bands who sound exactly like Iron Maiden. Since the mid-80s, Iron Maiden have been an arena-filling band in Europe and the UK and in North America and in South America. I mean, they're a band who can fill stadiums around the world. They've broken new ground for metal in many ways. You're playing a huge outdoor show in Bangalore. About 20 years ago, that was one of the big moments for metal in India. You know, there are bands who take their duty of taking their music all around the world absolutely seriously. If you ever see film of their shows in South America, it's berserk. You know, people really love them and they're playing to vast, vast, vast crowds. But they've done that by being consistent. They never tried to make commercial hair metal. They never put on makeup. They always did what they did, which was these long, intricately involved songs, often based on prog rock, often taken from history, and with certain defining elements in the sound, the twin lead guitars, and especially the gallop, the Iron Maiden gallop, the sound that powers so many of their songs. You know, they're an instantly recognisable band, and they have been for a very long time. They're a band who can still appeal to 14-year-olds because they still sound gory and grisly.
The author, Michael Hann. Still to come in this podcast.
I think my brain will permanently be rewired with the image of floating. My body keeps wanting to go back.
It's music, but not as we know it, as a violin player returns from space. Flood defences in Poland's third biggest city, Wrocław, look to have held firm for now after the worst floods in at least two decades ravaged central Europe this week, killing at least 23 people. The floods that have inundated the Polish-Czech border since the weekend reached the city of more than 600,000 overnight. The President of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, travelled to Wrocław on Thursday. She met the Prime Ministers of Poland, Austria, Slovakia and the Czech Republic to discuss EU support for the countries worst affected. This is what she announced after the meeting.
These are extraordinary times, and extraordinary times need extraordinary measures. At first sight, 10 billion euros are possible to mobilise from the cohesion funds for the countries that are affected. This is an emergency reaction now.
Ursula von der Leyen. Well, Paul Henley spoke to Sumini Singupta, the international climate reporter for the New York Times, and asked her what conclusions she drew from the announcement by Ursula von der Leyen.
Two things. One, it's an acknowledgement that even countries in Europe are having to urgently adapt to the hazards of extreme weather. And two, I'm struck by how much in emergency funding the European Union can mobilize. $10 billion is quite a lot of money. And it's not the kind of money that many low- and middle-income countries have when they face similar or far worse climate hazards.
What's the best way of spending that money, do you think?
Well, I can certainly tell you about the research that I have seen. There are many ways to adapt to what is becoming more frequent and more unpredictable extreme weather events. So for something like storms and flooding, there are a few things that are known to work. One is putting in place an early warning system that very clearly tells people what the weather projections are and advises them on what to do, including, you know, how to get to the closest shelters. That, of course, means having shelters around. In the long term, slightly harder things to do, things like prevent development in flood-prone areas or especially risky areas.
But where those areas are already developed, you'd have to pay people quite a lot of money to move permanently away from riverbanks, wouldn't you?
Well, and that's true, and that may not be necessary in instances like this. So in instances like this, it may well be necessary to shore up physical infrastructures, to make roads and bridges more capable of handling extreme rainfall. But we also know from other examples around the world, examples of extreme flooding, that the damages and the loss of life is really extreme when people are living in particularly risky areas.
We've only got a few seconds, but are you clear there is a connection between these floods and climate change, very briefly?
There is no direct connection between these floods being attributable to climate change. Those studies simply haven't been done yet. However, a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, which means that more extreme rainfall events are a hallmark of climate change.
Soumani Sengupta, the international climate reporter for The New York Times. A woman who was part of the expedition on board the ship which launched the ill-fated Titan mission to visit the sunken Titanic has given emotional testimony at a hearing into what went wrong. Renata Rojas said that after the sub's communication ceased last June, she worried, where are they? The US Coast Guard inquiry has also released new underwater footage of the wreck of the sub. Our science editor Rebecca Morell was watching proceedings.
Recorded nearly 3,800 metres down at the bottom of the Atlantic, the footage shows the Titan submersible in pieces on the seafloor. A metal dome can be seen coming apart from a ring of titanium, which is attached to the remnants of the hull. This is where the passengers would have been. The sub would have been crushed instantaneously by the immense pressure of the deep. The footage has been released by the US Coast Guard, which is trying to establish exactly what went wrong. There was also evidence from Renata Rojas, who was on board the support ship in 2023 when the Titan sub went missing with the loss of all five passengers. She was asked about how they had seemed before setting off.
They were just very happy to go. And that's the memory I have. Nobody was really nervous. They were excited about what they're going to see, make sure you have your camera. That type of thing.
The year before the disaster on the Titan, she had herself paid for a place on the sub. She said although things went wrong with that dive, there were problems controlling the vessel, she trusted OceanGate's safety protocols. The hearings continue.
Rebecca Morell. When archaeologists go digging, they're usually looking for lost treasure or statues and the remains of buildings from civilizations in the past. But a team of students in northern France found a note from a fellow archaeologist who'd been doing their job 200 years ago. Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield has more.
The team of students, led by a professional archaeologist, is conducting an excavation at a site called Caesar's Camp on cliffs north of Dieppe in Normandy. Though it's called Caesar's Camp, it is in fact the site of a fortified Celtic or Gaulish village, not dissimilar from the ones in the Asterix books. The dig was ordered because coastal erosion is gradually destroying the site, may well all have fallen into the sea in a few years' time. On Monday, one of the team, sifting through the earth, chanced upon a small jar, inside which was a glass flask, and inside that was a a tiny roll of paper tied with string. When they opened the paper, they found it was a message left behind by a certain P.J. Ferré, a local man who, the message said, in January 1825, was conducting an excavation on this very site. He'd left the note knowing or hoping that one day researchers would be back. So not quite the discovery the team was expecting, but a moment of archaeological magic nonetheless.
Hugh Schofield. Now to a story about a South American capybara that has catapulted a small family-run zoo in Telford in England into the headlines. Cinnamon, the giant rodent, escaped almost a week ago, and though her keepers tracked her down using thermal drones, they now say plans to capture her are temporarily on hold in case they scare the animal away. The zoo says the story of Cinnamon's escape has captured international attention. We got an update on the capybara from Will Dorrell, partner and zoo owner at Huzu and Dinosaur World.
She's been spotted two nights in a row, each time within about 5-10 metres of her previous location. It is woodland that is owned by the zoo, but the thicket that she goes to as soon as we turn up, it's pretty much impenetrable. Obviously not for a capybara, but for human beings. So it is making life a lot more difficult than obviously we anticipated at first. We are hoping that we can obviously entice her out of there, but we've just paused things at the moment because what we don't want to do is potentially end up forcing her to feel that she's got to move elsewhere and moving off-site and somewhere that could potentially be dangerous for her. She seems very, very comfortable. We sort of seemed to find her sort of den area last night, well, certainly an area that she's spending a lot of time. There was a lot of capybara poo around there. There's a huge amount of food and it's huge water sources there. There's several ponds in that woodland. We can see evidence that she's been to a couple of them. In the wild, if they felt threatened, the first thing they would do is dash to water and go underwater. But she is living her best life. It's literally a bit of a capybara's dream, which is great for her, not so great for us, because we can't really offer her something that she hasn't already got. They're very, very stocky animals. She's probably like the size of a large spaniel at the moment. So a large fox might be of a similar size, but they're not going to go for a capybara. Unfortunately, it was keeper error. One of our zookeepers, when they were entering her enclosure to mow it, so they were using a tractor with a mower on the back. They had to have the gate open for a short period of time as they went in. And standard protocol should be that they check the area immediately by the gate to make sure there's not a capybara near there. And on this occasion, they either did and didn't see her, or they forgot to check it.
Will Dorrell. These days, it's not that unusual to have long-distance link-ups between musicians in different countries. But now one group has taken the idea into new frontiers. That's a recording of Sarah Gillis playing a violin in space alongside musicians back on Earth. She returned last weekend after 5 days in orbit with SpaceX's Polaris Dawn and told Tim Franks that taking a violin into space is much trickier than you may think.
It was certainly a challenge to get there. On our mission, we were performing a spacewalk, and so the entire capsule went to vacuum. So there were all sorts of considerations for how we actually safely bring an instrument to space. We did have to put it in a vacuum chamber, put it through chemical and material testing. I did all sorts of measurements on exactly how much rosin was required to actually make sound. I think for me personally, one of my favorite moments was just seeing a wooden violin floating in this 21st century spacecraft. I think all of us were pretty emotional the first time we unpacked it and pulled it out.
Well, I can imagine. And obviously, you're talking about something that has been very fundamental to human existence for a very long time.
Music, absolutely.
Suddenly coming into close contact with something which is right at the very edge of our technological experience. And I guess it's worth underlining the fact that you are not just a very talented musician. You were also chief engineer on this project. So I guess it meant a lot to you.
Yeah, I think this whole mission has been very near and dear to my heart. So I had the immense privilege to contribute to the mission, both as a crew member in the spacecraft, but also on the development side, helping us figure out the procedures and go through all of the testing on the spacesuit and the mobility aids in support of the EVA.
The EVA, the extravehicular activity, as it's called, with you actually popping your head and, well, I guess some of your body out of the spacecraft.
Yeah, so our biggest mission objective was performing the first commercial spacewalk. And this has really been a massive development endeavor by the SpaceX team over the last 2.5 years. But for this mission, we were in a spacecraft with four people and there's no airlock. So what this required was actually venting the entire spacecraft to vacuum with all four crew members suited, and then opening the hatch to go out and collect data, go through some test matrix.
And I know, Sarah, that you've been very keen to emphasise that you were doing some serious research up there. You will also be aware that there have been some people who have said, you know, this was a mission that happened as a result of, put it crudely, a billionaire, Jared Isaacman, who had sort of money to burn on this exploration. What's your answer to that?
I think every single one of the objectives that was undertaken on this mission has very real application to the future of humanity in space. When you think about a future where we want to send hundreds of people to space, we want people to be able to live on planets someday. You can't have suits that require billions of dollars to build that are so custom for the spacewalk. This is the first time a commercial entity has taken on this challenge of actually starting the design cycle to build a suit that could someday support hundreds of people living in space. Communication over Starlink, it fundamentally can change how we interact both on Earth as well as with satellites and vehicles on orbit. It is an absolute game changer for how you can communicate and what you can actually accomplish. The science and research that we performed on this mission was very intentionally selected. We were able to get through almost 40 different research experiments looking at really how do you take people and allow them to go into space for longer.
Can I just ask how you are and how the violin is? Are you both doing okay since your return?
Absolutely. I'm doing so wonderfully. I think my brain will permanently be rewired with just the image of floating. My body keeps wanting to go back and just experience that true weightlessness again. But the violin is doing great. It survived full exposure to vacuum, stayed intact. It will actually be auctioned off at some point in the future. So watch out for that.
Sarah Gillis. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The producer was Stephanie Prentice. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.